Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boilo, Nazarita Goldhammer, your co-host at Epic Radio. Here we are, September 6th. Right back at you every Monday, rain or shine. We don't abide ourselves by the schedule of the government and governmental holidays. That would be silly. That would be going against the whole purpose of the radio show. So indeed, we are on the air. We chop wood. We carry water every day because this is the way. It's not to abide by the government, governmental holidays. So this is September 6th. It is Labor Day. Whatever in God's name does that mean? What does that mean? Labor Day. Celebrating the oppression and the totalization of the labor force? Is that what that celebrates? I'm just not sure about that. So it does enter into our discussion today, however. We are continuing our walk through a critical phenomenology of the earth and humans. Critical phenomenology that people don't find it easy to think creatively. I mean, really creatively. Think about new life paradigms. You know, anybody can come up with a new operating system, a more efficient work process. That's all just silly capitalist stuff. But that's not radicalizing thinking in any way, shape, or form. So critical phenomenology says let's get down into the deepest of the deep, the ontological, what forms the ontological, how we interpret being. That's the stuff that we're really interested in. And unfortunately, this level of discussion causes terror amongst the proletariat, the hoi polloi, the great unwashed, as people will choose a miserable, comfortable habit over a new world that could be much better in every way. So when we wrote our first try at a critical phenomenology, oh my gosh, that must have been almost 10 years ago. It was called the Critical Existential Psychoanalysis book. And that's where we're trying to lay open the idea that phenomenology has a critical function. What's interesting is that phenomenology has not gone away. It's become the queen of the sciences. And the reason for that is because it grounds our most fervent sciences in the life world as it really is, in the ecosystems as they really are, the animals as they really are, who they are, who humans are, what we are. It's not just a set of sciences that perfect efficiencies or capitalist revenues. Those are all silly. Those people who operate on that level, they're silly. They're superficial. I have no ill will towards them. They just don't know better. But what we're talking about is grounding sciences, all of them, in the actual life world. I want you to think about the depth of that. That means to figure out the meaning question. What is the meaning of the human? What is the meaning of the human in this climate change situation? and the total destruction of several ecosystems, the forced extinction of many species. Is that a science that's grounded in the life world? I don't think so. I think in principle, if we're destroying the ecosystem, the biosphere, other life forms, then in principle, we don't have sciences that are grounded in the life world, neither the life world of the human nor the life world of the non-human. That's the problem we're dealing with. Positive science always creates an excitement amongst those who think they can make a buck or gain a status. Right now in America, medical doctor training is a joke because it's completely harnessed by capitalism and the belief that we are somehow more important and more superior than other life forms, including trees and rivers, including other animal forms who have eyes just like us, and nervous systems just like us, and families just like us. And they'll look you right in the eye with total idiocy because they have consumed way too much Kool-Aid. Phenomenology is a challenge to all of us. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult subject, especially because it ties to the choice of ontologies, which involves higher mass, topology, game theory, fair division, set theory, category theory. And these theories actually work. I know because I had to study them. And as I studied them, I started learning of the elegance and the beauty, for example, of set theory, category theory. We do have influence and power over the way things appear to us and beings appear and the earth itself appears to us. So we've been hell-bent on growing, producing as many children as possible. One of the great tenets of some of the world's greatest religions. And we know now that that was utter stupidity. We have too many humans. There are maybe 300,000 chimpanzees left. Our nearest evolutionary cousin, maybe 300,000. And what do we have, 8 billion people, pushing towards 8 billion people, more or less? We're out of control. We need to stop breeding under the name of religion, or under any name, for that matter. So critical phenomenology means to back up, to stop. It means to really scrutinize the question of the other. So I'm going to bring Nazarita out to the show. Let's talk about how capitalism sees the other, how competition sees the other, how the United States sees the other. Here's some examples. The homeless population has increased in numbers. It's huge, and it's increasing even more, where people might not even have a car to sleep in. They're sleeping on the street. High school students sleeping on the street. People borrowing a couch from a friend or a family member. And then there's the other poor. The other poor, they've lost their jobs. They can't get them back. Or the only kind of job they can get is a mindless, menial job that will drive them crazy. They no longer have their house that they had a mortgage on. They couldn't afford it. They're being forced to vaccinate themselves against viruses that we could prevent from seeping into the human population. We're being forced into apartments two and three family groups into one little apartment. Check it out. In L.A., Philadelphia, Chicago, it's happening all over. Because people can't afford otherwise. And you've got five, six, seven people sleeping to a bedroom. People are living in their cars. A lot of people have just quit because they've quit their jobs. Why would they quit their job? I'll tell you why. Because they work, sometimes two earner families work 50, 60, 70 hours a week each. And they have children. And they still don't have enough money to survive. So that means that's a system that doesn't work. That's why a person would quit that. People sell everything and they live in their car until their car breaks down, or they live in a truck, or they buy an RV, or they convert a van. It's the whole idea of the American dream and having a mortgage and having a pool. It's a shrinking phenomenon, and it's reserved only for the affluent who don't care. They spend, most of them, in my opinion, there are always exceptions, but many affluent people don't do anything for others. They feel like they deserve it, which is just another idiocy. They don't deserve it any more than anybody else. They have two, three, four, five, six homes, 10 homes all over the world. And there are people on the street. Then there are even people even worse condition. People in some African communities, some Middle Eastern countries, they don't have anything. They don't have food, they don't have water, and they die. There's something wrong in that system. That is not a just and sustainable system. We have deforested way too many forests. We're now deforesting the Amazon. Absolute stupidity. And why do we do it? To grow more cattle, to feed Americans more beef. And I'll tell you right now, the people who eat meat and dairy should be ashamed of themselves. They're immoral, or they're stupid, or they're both. They're not smart, and they're not aware, and they have no empathy. Now, they have pretend empathy with their kin and their family members. But they go right on doing the same thing. It's the, what I would call, it's the great complicit, the accomplices. And so, fundamentally, there's a self-structure that does not see the other for who the other is and what the other needs. We don't see the other as just as important as us. Now in South Africa, they've created a new law. They've decriminalized poaching of chimpanzees, taking little babies from their mommies. They kill the moms. They take the baby. They now pay a tax. Give it 10 years, and we'll have 20,000 left. They're going to be on the verge of extinction. And people don't care. They continue feeding their little fat tummies and buying their big houses because they deserve it. And their whole lives are filled with aesthetic pleasure, pleasure of the flesh, pleasure of the mouth, pleasure of the space, pleasure of the sun, pleasure of the money, going on trips, buying and buying and buying consumer items. Well, we can't do it anymore. So critical phenomenology of the earth and of humans says, let's be critical. Let's look at it. And the way we look at it is through phenomenology. We drill back down into the idea of the life world. There's beautiful literature coming out. I'm so excited to read. But a lot of these writers, they might not even know how profound their work is. But there's a new literature about the ecosystems, the beauty of ecosystems, the beauty of the Earth biosphere, Gaia, the Gaia hypothesis from James Lovelock. we don't understand that the life world means we have to transcend our ideologies about money and looks, all the stuff on social media. It's all a bunch of garbage. It's worthless. The time that people take to post stupid things about themselves or their stupid kids, it is a waste of time. Right now, the earth is sinking. It's dying. And there are people like me and Nazarita and others who know this is happening. This is not a doomsday distortion. This is facts. We have the facts. We have the truth. So critical phenomenology says, let's dig into the way the earth is and the way animals are and other species are, who they are in their own reality. Not who we make of them for our own capitalist, selfish enterprises. You have to do critical phenomenology into the life world if you're going to do effective design. You can't be an astute interior or exterior designer if you don't understand critical phenomenology. You can't do it anymore. You're old, you're passé. You have to get into the new and you have to understand what's going on. We have killed off 60% of the Earth's large land mammals since 1970. 50 short years, we've killed them. They didn't kill themselves, we killed them. So critical phenomenology has to do a few things. Number one, it has to do a hard target, a probative search into the life world, not just the human life world, but the life world of all life. Number two, we need to understand how ecosystems work and our place within those ecosystems. And number three, we need to have a massive conversion process out of the selfish ideologies, the narcissistic enterprises that we engage in. If we don't do it, we are doomed. Why are people so up in arms about sexism and genderism and racism? Why? Because they know there's something wrong. We know that people aren't being treated fairly. But they need to radicalize that idea across all species groups, all rivers, all lakes, all oceans, all marine animals, all land animals, all plant and tree species, microbes, every living being that makes up this beautiful Earth spaceship. So critical phenomenology does just that. That's what it is. And that is the right name for it. It's the logos of phenomena. The logos that we create by choosing ontological structures, by how we presence being, how we interpret it. That is what it is. And if we can start aiming in that direction and push aside lower idols and lower gods and false idols, we have a shot at using critical phenomenology to design a new earth. Nazarita, welcome to the show. Sorry I spoke so long. All love to hear what you have to say about how we can use critical phenomenology, drilling into the life world, to redesign our spaceship Earth. Welcome.
Thank you. I really have enjoyed it. You never talk too long. Because what we're discussing is so important. You can't actually say everything and really delve into what we're talking about in 3 minutes. It's just not possible. But we started off by looking at what is celebrated Labor Day, which has actually become just another holiday that some people can take off. Not all people, that some some can take off to extend a vacation before they get back into the normal rhythm of where they were before summer started. So one of the questions that everybody sees who is anyway connected with social media or reads anything connected with clothing or interior design or anything is the big loaded question of social dilemma, which is, can you wear white after Labor Day? Now, if you're not a woman, maybe this doesn't even seem like this is relevant, but women have been brought up with this question from the time that we're little. You can't wear white after Labor Day. Now, this is preposterous, but this goes to the point that we're talking about. It's the division of the wealthy from the middle class or the poor, because that's how this was started. This was started in the 19th century, where the ultra rich were in battle with the newly rich. And so they created these certain rules that if the newly rich knew them, they could be part of the gang of the rich, wealthy rich, you know, inherited rich. Meanwhile, the poor folk, they can't go out and buy all this white summer wear, because white was a symbol of leisure. And so the question has come down to us in culture, can you wear white after Labor Day? Because people wore dark clothes until summer, and then they wore lighter clothes, and then they put them away to go back to their normal life of school and work and all these places that required clothing that didn't show dirt as much, right? Which, of course, we have Labor Day, which is highlighting the achievements of workers. Let's just be really clear on what this is. The achievements of workers, celebrating workers, workers that actually keep our whole culture alive. It isn't, you know, it's these people who sweep the streets and clean the houses and pick the cotton and pick your berries from the grocery store. These are the people that actually run the culture. And without them, it doesn't matter how much money you have, if somebody's not going to go get your vegetables from the garden, you're not going to have the vegetables. So it also trickles down to blue-collar worker, white-collar worker. And that's why this is important. We live with these trite sayings and questions almost every season and day of our cultural lives, of which, if we don't question them and buck them, then how are we supposed to go deeper and buck the questions that arise and are put out there for normal people who want to live simple, nonviolent lives? People who are nonviolent are considered radical. This is the whole culture that we live in. We're radical if we don't want to murder and eat other beings with eyes. That's the radical. And I find this to be really interesting, and we don't want to use pesticides and herbicides on any growing thing that's growing so that it grows kind of wild. We're looked on as radical, not fitting into the culture. But these things all need to be questioned. In response to your question of how do we begin, if we can't question what we're doing, then we're really lost. And I saw this part of a documentary with Jane Goodall on chimps. And chimps are known to be really playful. They love to play. They're extremely curious, and they're problem solvers. They're just like us. And so, but for a lot of us, we've forgotten how to play, how to really engage in the beauty of the earth and the feel of the grass and the smell of the air and the trees and clean water. And then we've become not curious. We've bought into sayings that have been passed down to us by the extreme wealthy and rich by saying we have our place and we have to stay in our place. And that place is you work with your head down, what do they call it, down to the grindstone, right? Isn't that an interesting? Put your nose to the grindstone. So the nose is meant to be curious, you know, sniffing out trouble when you're curious. I can smell trouble. Curiosity is with the nose. And yet, here's the thing. Put your nose to the grindstone. And yet we fail to question these trite sayings that are part of our culture that seemingly motivate the worker to do more for who? That's why we have the culture now, the young culture that is becoming more astute. They're realizing that working 9-to-5 jobs for somebody else, missing their whole life, not able to be curious or question, to have a certain rules that they have to live by for these period of time during their lives every single day, on call, answering to some big boss who tells them what to do it, how they should dress, how they should act, what they should say. And everybody wonders, why are the young going to van life, getting vans and traveling instead of staying in one place and working as what is expected of them? So we should all be looking at some of these trite things that go on in our culture. That's the beginning of our reawakening of our curiosity. Instead of going wholeheartedly with things and sayings that are instilled in us that we follow instinctively, we should say, are we really following something that is true? You know, there's a lot of sayings like, is it true? Is it true? Is it kind? Will it promote the well-being of others? Will it promote the well-being of yourself? Is it something that is for others? And I think that's where we begin to have critical phenomenology. We start to question, to become curious, to say, where did this come from? Why are we celebrating Labor Day? The celebration of Labor Day should be that workers should be off, but in truth, a lot of workers are not. They're serving at restaurants. They're having big Labor Day sales where you can consume and buy things. And so we have to really look at that. What are we really celebrating? We're just celebrating another finally day off, right, from the work that we do, that thank God we get a small break. We don't care what it's for. It could be National Cat Day, and if it were a day off, everybody would take it. So that's where we begin, and my thinking is to reawaken, like chimps, our curiosity, our play instinct, our wanting to be problem solvers instead of just following, you know, blindly what others think and sayings of our society. I think that's where we start.
So what I heard you laying out, which is great, is that there are ideologies in our culture. There are distortions caused by the economic structure called capitalism. There are hidden distortions. People just accept that things are the way they are. That critical theory is a discourse that's used to investigate and uncover cultural lies. That's what it does. That was its whole purpose, starting with Marx. So there's all kinds of lies. And one simple lie is that people will go to the malls and they'll buy a lot of goods that they actually don't need, that were made by exploiting other people in some other part of the world and digging precious minerals out of the ground, which hurt groundwater. So there's a backstory, in other words, and I call it the cultural unconscious. Critical theory exposes these in a nice way. In terms of individuals, psychoanalysis, I think, and there are many different types of psychoanalysis, but it's a way of examining the human and understanding what's going on for each human or a particular human. You know, how are they relating to these problems? I personally find that really fascinating, because if we don't figure out why it is that people, like, why it is that the complacent are complacent, then they're never going to change their self-structure. It's not a given that people would be complacent. It's the culture that creates that. And so critical phenomenology says, look, let's dig down into the ground. Let's figure out what the life world is, free from all these ideologies and distortions, free from the economic system. You know, wouldn't it be nice to really understand the Earth biosphere better? For me, it's fascinating. I learn something new every day about how the Earth works. And so that information is really important. You know, how the life world of the interface of humans with the rest of the Earth works. That's pretty fascinating. And so we have a trope, an ideology right now in the Western culture and the East that suggests that humans are superior to all other life forms, that they have the right to dominate, colonize, and conquer the Earth and all the other beings on the Earth, and they have the right to conquer themselves. And so we hurt people in our own species group. It's unbelievable the amount of violence that we perpetrate on other humans. Nazarita, we've talked about this. It's pretty outrageous. It's pretty severe. And we just keep on doing it. If you open up any news feed, really, in the United States, seriously, almost any, you will hear reports of massive amounts of violence, like gratuitous violence. Now, we don't, you know, without getting into the interpretation of the violence and, you know, different news networks having different political beliefs, we don't have to go there. Just look at the amount of out-of-control violence. I mean, isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's very interesting. Why does that occur? I want to know. Don't you want to know? Sure, because it's getting worse. Here we are. I'll give you one really big example. We're destroying the Amazon rainforest. I can't think of anything that's more stupid, more destructive, more counterproductive, more geared towards ending all life on this planet, and definitely the human life, than deforesting the Amazon. This is the great, one of the, probably the largest regulator of carbon gases and global warming in the whole planet. And here we are torching it. Not only are we torching it, but we're putting something in its place. We're grazing cattle to make hamburgers. And when you graze cattle to make hamburgers, you don't treat the cattle very well, and you end up slaughtering them in the end. They don't want to be slaughtered. And that's another thing that both critical theory and psychoanalysis uncover. The falseness that cattle deserve to be slaughtered, or that that's their lot in life, or that was their purpose because some Christian God said so. That's ridiculous. They don't want to be slaughtered. They're very sentient and very loving beings. So that is one moral catastrophe. The second one is that people who own those ranches kill any other predator that comes by. Could be coyotes, could be wolves, lions, all over the world. There's another moral catastrophe. Number three, raising cattle, using feedlots, and building slaughter plants and rendering plants pollutes groundwater. Indisputable. There's another catastrophe. Here's another one. Raising cattle creates more carbon dioxide gases and more methane gases. There's another moral catastrophe. So it's just one example of how humans aren't as smart as they think they are. And it's shameful. So if you start doing a life world analysis, there are indigenous people who live in the Amazon rainforest, and they're killed by ranchers or land speculators. So there, we've destroyed the life world of an indigenous group of people who've been in that region their whole lives and many, many generations. A life world analysis would take into account the lives of the cattle, the lives of all the plants, the water, and all the animals and beings in the forest that was just destroyed. That's part of the life world. Life world, the world of the living. So you can see here how really cool in a way, but how right on the money critical phenomenology is. It hones right in on the right place. Sciences could be used to give us a better understanding of the life world. And ultimately, understanding the life world means understanding the other and respecting the other. And that's really what it's all about. That's what this radio show has been about for 8 years, is understanding the other, being more empathetic towards the other, working with the other, coexisting with the other, designing for the other, and not feeding this being inside of us who just wants to be at the center of everything. So Nazarita, maybe in our remaining 6.5 minutes, you can start to speculate how we can get people together to think in these ways. And there's nothing bad or evil or rotten in a critical phenomenology. There's nothing destructive. How can we get people to consider a radically new phenomenology of the earth?
From just a human point of view, if you're open to really understanding why others react to a certain way or to certain, you know, rules, regulations, or why they're afraid or why they're fearful of you know, wolves, or why they're fearful of, you know, different areas where they want to destroy the earth or destroy the other. I think first it takes, you know, a certain group of people that have a real fear. And what it takes is open dialogue, because, you know, in China, they had the one-child policy. And then when they realized they didn't have any people, any workers, put it differently, any workers, they said, oh, well, we can allow 2 children now. And, oh, maybe we can allow 3. So rules never really address the problem. What they do is they blanket the problem, the underlying problems. The underlying problems, people will always find a way to get through those laws and regulations if you don't address the underlying cause. And this happens with everything, medication, everything. If you don't address the underlying cause of the disparity between people who are nonviolent or violent, people who eat meat and don't eat meat, if you can't understand and address that, they will never change. You have to be able to get through to that. So I think for me, that's the beginning of trying to be open to understand and to address that underlying problem, that anxiety, that fear that goes along with not wanting to change certain ways of living. And not all people, there are some people who are obviously extremely violent no matter what, and there isn't an underlying cause, they enjoy it. But there is another group of people that would change if they really understood and could have their feelings addressed. So that's what I believe would be the first step.
Right. So in my moral theory classes, I always divided people up into 3 groups. Not in, not in the class, but people in general, you've got the morally gifted. They always get it right. They're morally astute. Then you've got the other group, the serial killers, the violent, the people who harm animals, harm the earth, and even the complacent. They'll never get it right. There's something wrong with them. Excuse me. But 90% of all people are teachable, and they can learn, and they can transform. That's the group we want to focus on. That's the group that can transform and change. If you apply pressure here and there, some education processes. But one of the things you just said really struck me, as it always does, as being so apt, and that is fear. There are people now in their mid to late 60s, 70s, and they are so obsessed with their Medicare, their health insurance, their 401k, money in the bank, and all these little accoutrements of being a United States citizen. And they have nothing else. They've cultivated nothing in their life except fear. And what they've done, you can look at their life. Their life is just a pure genealogy of dealing with fear. They live a fear-based life. And consequently, they give nothing. When these people die, the epitaph on their little headstone should read, "You did nothing, really," or "Your life amounted to nothing." So, yeah, it's easy to be friendly to kids and family members. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about kinship inclinations. We're talking about sacrificing your own good. There are people who could go out and make millions and millions of dollars or more. But they don't. They choose something else. They choose to give their life energy for the other, for the earth, for the betterment of humanity. That's different. That's prioritizing the other. It's a different position than being. It is an acute awareness of the interrelational feature and foundation of our very beingness. And, you know, we've talked about that quite a bit, our inner subjectivity. But it's more than human inner subjectivity. It's inner species, inner life, inner subjectivity. You know, respecting the very beautiful relationship between canines and humans, or higher level primates, chimpanzees and humans, or cetaceans and humans, or elephants and humans. We're missing out on so much that is part of the life world, and that's what I'm trying to get at. If we can be a little more astute and do a little bit more research and exploration into the science of our life world and really understand it, we're going to be a lot better at respecting it. And so I'm excited to get to become part of this quest, I guess you'd call it, and these projects. So that's all we have for today, folks. We're completely out of time. This is Epith Radio, Nazarita Goldhammer, Kevin Boyle, wishing you all a good day and a good week. And we'll be right back at you September 13th, which is the following Monday. This is Epis Radio signing out.